to the book of 1 Peter. To begin with, quite a few scholars expressed doubt that the book was even written by Peter. And there's two main arguments put forward for that idea. The first is that the Greek language used in the book is highly advanced. In other words, it's very, very, very well written. There's even some evidence that the writer was trained in classical Greek rhetoric. The argument is that's put forward is that Peter was a commercial fisherman. He was a newfie. Even if he knew Greek, he wouldn't be able to produce something as elegant as this epistle. But I think the rebuttal to that argument is found in chapter 5, verse 12 of 1 Peter, where Peter admits that he didn't write it. The ideas found in the book were his, but Silvanus was the guy who actually put the pen to paper. Silvanus is kind of the long version of the name Silas. And we don't really know where Silas went to school, but it was probably a pretty good school. Now, the other argument is that Peter's writing to Christians in the Roman provinces of Asia Minor who appear to be dealing with some kind of persecution. And the problem in the minds of scholars is that the first recorded persecution against Christians was initiated by the Emperor Nero Claudius Caesar Augustus Germanicus. That was his, he had to put that in his business card. In 64 AD. And we know him simply as Nero, but what he did was, there was a big fire in Rome in 64 AD, and whatever else is true about it, Nero blamed it on the Christians. Peter was executed during that persecution. And the problem is the most likely date for the authorship of the book of 1 Peter, I don't know, it's somewhere around the year 62, 63 AD, which is before that persecution hit. Now, I think the rebuttal to that idea is that, I think persecutions probably don't exactly start on the hour. We don't have a moment-by-moment history of the ancient Roman world. What we have is most of the main events. We don't have a narrative of the circumstances that led up to that 64 AD persecution. What we do know is this. We know this from history. In the year 60 AD, Nero publicly declared that he was the incarnation of the Roman god Apollo. And emperor cults rose up at that time in which people would gather at ceremonies. And the way that you expressed the divinity of Nero was you'd pour out some wine on the ground. It was called a libation. And you declared Nero to be divine. Well, there was no law that people had to do this. That did come into effect around the year 200 AD. But Christians were conspicuously absent from this cult of emperor worship, and Nero didn't like that. Nero looked at these guys and said, so there's evidence, I think, that there was at least social persecution, some economic persecution, religious persecution, intolerance. All of these things were kind of gaining momentum around the time that Peter wrote this epistle. Nero didn't just randomly grab a minority group and blame the fire of Rome on them. I think this antagonism against Christians had been festering for a while. Now, before we jump right into the biblical text here, there's one more interesting feature of this book of Peter I want to point out to you. Dave talked about this a couple of weeks ago. It's in the first sentence of the book, and this has been a huge controversy over the centuries. The text tells us that Peter wrote this book to the strangers or the exiles or the expatriates or however you translate this word, scattered throughout the provinces of Asia Minor. And the word we're looking at here in ancient Greek is, oops, there's the title, is Parapidemos, or Parapidemos. The problem with this word is that it's a hapax legomenon. You all know what that means, right? It's just a fancy term to describe a word that only appears once in the Bible. In fact, parapidemos only appears once in all of ancient literature. That makes it really hard to translate because we've got nothing to compare it to. But let me try and break this word down for you, because I think this word is extremely important to us. The prefix para. Para is a Greek term that means looks like or resembles or is similar to, parallel, two things together. But this word can also be understood as meaning other than or beyond. I think this is how para is used in this word. Now, pe is simply a Greek article. Articles are words like and, the, an. And demos is a derivative of the word demos. The word means a district. Contextually, the Greeks used this word to describe people. It's where the word democracy comes from. It comes from demos kratia. The rule of the people. Now, directly translated, this word means beyond the people. The connotation is sort of not part of the dominant culture. It doesn't really mean that you're outside the dominant culture. It really is to those of you beyond the dominant culture. And I think this is how Peter perceived the Christians scattered throughout Asia Minor. And I believe it's how we should perceive ourselves in this day and age. We're in this culture, we're participants in society around us, but as Christians, we're living somewhat beyond the people around us who don't know Jesus Christ. We're citizens of a much different kingdom than they are. And that can lead to some tensions. Now, let's take a look at our text for the week. 1 Peter chapter 2, beginning with verse 4. This is from the New International Version. Here's what it says. It says, as you come to him, the living stone, rejected by humans but chosen by God and precious to him, you also, like living stones, are being built into a spiritual house to be a holy priesthood, offering spiritual sacrifices acceptable to God through Jesus Christ. For in Scripture it says, see, I lay a stone in Zion, a chosen and precious cornerstone, and the one who trusts in him will never be put to shame. Now, to you who believe, this stone is precious, but to those who do not believe, the stone the builders rejected has become the cornerstone, and a stone that causes people to stumble and a rock that makes them fall. They stumble because they disobey the message, which is also what they were destined for. But you are a chosen people, a royal priesthood, a holy nation, God's special possession, that you may declare the praises of him who called you out of darkness into his wonderful light. Once you were not a people, but now you are the people of God. Once you had not received mercy, but now you have received mercy. In John chapter 1, verse 42, we read about the first meeting between Jesus and Peter. Andrew, Peter's brother, had already spent a whole day listening to Jesus, and he'd become convinced that Jesus was the Messiah that Israel was waiting for. So he ran and got his brother, Simon Peter, and he brought him to meet Jesus. And Jesus took one look at him, and he said these words. He said, you are Simon, son of John, and you will be called Cephas. The language on the street at the time of Jesus Christ was Aramaic. There was quite a few languages floating around. In Aramaic, Cephas means stone or rock. There's no separate term for the two sort of ideas of this. There's no differentiation, rock, stone. Now, in this passage I just read to you, in this passage from 1 Peter, seven times Peter uses the term lithos, which is the Greek translation for stone. And once he uses petra, which is the Greek word for rock, which is the play on words that Jesus employed when he called Simon Cephas. Simon's Greek name was Petros, and the Greek word for rock is Petra. And I think that by the time this epistle was written, this letter from Peter, the whole Christian world had heard this story about Peter's name. And Peter was known throughout Christianity as the rock. And this word had a very special meaning to Peter. And he used it as a metaphor for what he wanted to say to these Christians in Asia Minor. Now, here's what Peter was dealing with. It's obvious from the content of this epistle that there had been some kind of persecution. The Christians had been scattered. The word Peter used was diaspora, dispersed. It's where our word dispersion comes from. They'd been dispersed throughout the Roman Empire, and Roman provinces. And I think that the temptation faced by anyone who finds themselves isolated and rejected by the mainstream culture is to go to ground, to keep your head down, to sort of retreat into the shadows, to withdraw. A lot of people facing opposition and persecution at any level will simply back away or back out. I once met an Egyptian Coptic Christian in my travels who had a cross tattooed on his wrist. And I asked him about it. And when I did, I discovered that it's customary for Christians, Coptic Christians in Egypt, to have a cross like this tattooed on the inside of their wrist. And Egypt is a predominantly Muslim nation, and the Christians there experience a fairly high degree of social and economic persecution. And the Christian I spoke with explained that one of the main reasons they put the tattoo on their wrist is so that they won't be able to fall into the temptation to deny Christ when things get really tough. And Coptic Christians fully expect persecution to increase in their world. Peter was writing to a people who were dealing with the temptation to retreat behind their walls and kind of disappear into the woodwork. And I believe that's a very real temptation in today's world as well. Right here in Canada, you know, we sing our national anthem, God keep our land glorious and free. But we're not really feeling that freedom as Christians. In fact, more and more, we're feeling like we exist a little bit beyond the culture. So let's take a look at Peter's encouragement for people trying to live as spiritual foreigners in the land into which they were born. The first thing Peter did in this passage was he pointed people to the center, to Christ. We always want to maintain a Christocentric faith. And in the opening words of his passage, Peter called Jesus the living stone. Whenever we find ourselves rejected by the world, the great temptation is not so much to let go of the truth, it's to compromise with the lie. Peter took the Asian Christians straight to the ancient truth of the book of Isaiah in the Old Testament, and he quoted the words of God, the words that came right out of God's mouth, and where he said, "See, I lay a stone in Zion, a chosen and precious cornerstone, and the one who trusts in him will never be put to shame. Now to you who believe, this stone is precious, but to those who do not believe, The stone the builders rejected has become the cornerstone, and a stone that causes people to stumble and a rock that makes them fall. So the first thing Peter did was he pointed the persecuted Christians to Christ. Secondly, he drew a line between them and Christ. And he basically said, now look at how you're connected here. Jesus himself was chosen to be the cornerstone of life, but he was rejected by the builders. Jesus was marginalized. He was persecuted. He was pushed away. The implication Peter was trying to communicate to the Asian Christians was, if this is what happened to the one they put their trust in, they ought to logically expect the same thing to happen to them. This should not be coming as a surprise. It's part of the cost of following the king, this kind of pressure. Now, the third thing that Peter did was he explained to the Asian Christians that the people who were persecuting them, the people who were judging them, were actually in the process of falling flat on their spiritual faces as they did it. And again, quoting from the prophet Isaiah, Peter reminded them that Jesus was also a stone that causes people to stumble and a rock that makes them fall. You know, many, many years ago, I was in the city of Urumqi in the People's Republic of China. Urumqi is sandwiched between Tibet and Mongolia. It's a very strange place on this earth. And this was back in the tough days of communism, where there were no cars owned except by the government. Everyone drove a bicycle to work to earn their $30 a month, which was the wage back then. And almost every day I was in Urumqi, I would go downtown because I'd witnessed this amazing sight and I wanted to see it again and again. It was the spectacle of thousands upon thousands upon thousands of people on bicycles making their way down the main street of Urumqi. And it was a sight to behold. I was baffled by it, how they could do it. One day, I was down there, one morning, I went down there to watch, and an ambulance appeared on the main street of Urumqi. And I watched as it turned off the side road onto the main road and drove straight toward this oncoming sea of bicycles. And I thought, someone's going to be killed here. This is insane. Nope. Like a rock thrown into a stream, that onrushing current of bicycles simply divided around that ambulance, kept going their way. And I can remember looking at it and thinking, that's what Jesus Christ does. He moves through this world and he forces people one way or another. He forces people to make a choice. You cannot remain neutral about Jesus Christ. You either choose him or reject him. Even refusing to make the choice ends up as a choice. That's why he's a rock that causes people to stumble. Now, there's a line that Peter throws in here that causes a lot of consternation in the world of today. And it's the last part of verse 8, and it says, they stumble because they disobey the message, which is also what they were destined for. And I mean, when I was just down in Cranbrook, and I had a bunch of young people, and they went, we talked about this verse, and they said, that's not fair. How can God create people and then destine them to stumble and disobey? And this has been a topic of dispute since the church began. It fires up all kinds of thoughts about predestination and election and how God calls and chooses people. Here's how this works. In 2 Timothy 2:4, we read that God our Savior wants all people to be saved and come to a knowledge of the truth. But God, in his omniscience, knows that not all will. So he draws to himself those who he knows will come. And conversely, he allows those he knows won't come to go ahead and disobey the message of the truth. God has foreknowledge of who will come to him and who won't. It doesn't mean he desires people to reject him. He just knows ahead of time who will. Of course, the other part of the equation is, what about people who have never heard the message of the truth? And here's the deal with them. God doesn't judge people for what they don't know. He judges them for what they do know. If the person who's never heard of Christ is aware that stealing is wrong and they go ahead and steal, then they'll be judged for stealing. People don't get judged for not knowing about Jesus Christ. They get judged for their sins. What we possess is the great remedy to the problem. And that's why we need to go into the world and make disciples of all nations. We need to share the remedy. It's not because we're a bunch of intolerant know-it-alls. It's because we have the grace of having the cure in our hands, the cure to sin, and we need to extend that to others around us. Which brings us to the fourth thing that Jesus had to say to the persecuted Christians in Asia Minor. And this is astounding. He said this. He said, "But you are a chosen people, a royal priesthood, a holy nation, God's special possession, that you may declare the praises of him who called you out of darkness into his wonderful light." I want you to notice here that this passage is in the plural. Somewhere in the last couple of hundred years, along with the very positive realization that we follow a personal God, came the distortion that Christianity is an individual endeavor. It is not. Everything about it is corporate. Peter didn't say, "You are a chosen person." He said, "You are a chosen people." We're a community of those who God in his omniscience knew would respond to his grace and mercy. Theologically, I need to confess that I'm still trying to figure out how this works. Do we choose God or does he choose us? And I think the best answer to that question is yes. But take a look at what we're chosen to. This is Peter's ultimate response to Christians under pressure. You're a chosen people. You know, the longer a church is around, the more baggage it accumulates. After 30 or 40 years of a church being around, there's all this relational history that kind of sticks to a church community. One person remembers when they were passed up for a ministry role. Another remembers when someone got bossy about something. One time someone got short with another person and they're remembering. Another time someone had one of their ideas vetoed. We're a chosen people, a community of love. We're all bumpy and wrinkly and annoying in some way or another. But we need to be a family. We're God's kids. And that should mean something. Not only that, but Peter calls us a royal priesthood. Not just a priesthood, but a royal priesthood. The Greek word for a sacred place is hieron. The word Peter uses here is hieratuma, sacred ones, a royal sacred ones. A holy nation, God's special possession. And then Peter drives it home. This is his punchline. He says that you might declare the praises of him who called you out of darkness into his wonderful light. You know, the title of this sermon is Sojourn, The Rock and Your Role. Jesus Christ is the rock, and because he's the rock, our role is to declare who he is. When we find ourselves pressured and marginalized and rejected by society around us, We look to the rock, and then we declare his praises. And that doesn't mean we close the door and hold hands and sing kumbaya to each other. That context here is outward facing. This verse is missional. We need to remember why we're here. You know, some years ago I was in Amsterdam at a conference held by the Billy Graham Association, and I sat down at a table and I introduced myself to a pastor from southern Somalia who was sitting across from me. He spoke remarkably good English. And as we got talking, I discovered that 1 week before, radical Muslim terrorists had broken into his church, pushed open the doors, ran up to the front. They dragged members of his congregation out into the street. One trigger-happy young radical opened up on the crowd with his AK-47, and the pastor's wife and one of his daughters was killed. Now that's persecution. And when I asked this pastor why he had come to Amsterdam such a short time after this incredible personal tragedy in his life, he said, "People who would do such things need Jesus Christ in their lives. I'm here to learn how to lead Muslims to Christ." You know, when the truth causes us to be rejected by the world around us, that's the wrong time to start buying into the lies. The right response is to shout the truth even louder and trust God to protect us and press back the darkness around us. Which brings us to the fifth and final thing Peter had to say to the persecuted Christians in Asia Minor. He said, "Once you were not a people, but now you are the people of God. Once you had not received mercy, but now you have received mercy." Do you know what Peter was saying? He was saying, you may be foreigners in the land in which you live, but you're not foreigners in the kingdom of God. This is your home. You belong. You have a father who presides over this household. You may be foreigners and sojourners in this world, but you are not without a home. And the gift of God to all you outcasts, all you parapidimois, those who exist beyond the rest of the world, is this unfathomable mercy of God. You know, more than 40 years ago, when I was still a student at Bible college, I made a prediction to the student body of CBC. I said, the world isn't going to persecute Christians because we believe in Jesus Christ. I said, the world is going to persecute Christians because we only believe in Jesus Christ. That's what the Romans had against the Christians here that Peter's writing to. It's what the world has against us. Jesus said, "I am the way, the truth, and the life. No one comes to the Father but by me." The world sees that as an incredibly arrogant statement. Other religions see that as an incredibly arrogant statement. And you know what? They'd be absolutely right if it wasn't for one simple fact. And that fact is that it's true. In John 8:32, Jesus said, "You will know the truth, and the truth will set you free." The pressure we experience in the world around us is not because we have different ideas from them. It's not because we disagree with them. We live as foreigners in the land of our birth because we understand that Jesus is the truth. And that's something that is never, ever going to change.